I'm Evan Kleinman of Angeli Cafe, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. We're waist deep into holiday season today with sparkling wines to drink and a side dish extravaganza. Plus etiquette tips on how to survive really boring people at a holiday party and what food to leave out for Santa, that guy with the jiggly belly. First, let's get to the farmers markets to see what's in season this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. It's almost the holidays, and we are so excited at the market to be creating wonderful farm fresh dishes to share with family and friends. And we've managed to catch up with Dave Rubel, who is a longtime market friend, aficionado, and a fantastic private chef. And Dave, as always, is looking and cooking. And maybe you can help us out with a really interesting seasonal dish we could serve to special people this holiday season.
Well, one of the things I know I'm going to do for the holiday on Tuesday with my family is a toasted orzo dish with caramelized onions and wild mushrooms, and I'm going to finish it off with some of the white truffles that are available here at the farmer's market.
Tell us what orzo is and how you cook it.
Orzo is actually a pasta that's shaped like rice. You can get it, you know, Barilla Pasta makes it, a lot of the pasta you can get it, DiCecco has it, they call it riso. What I do is, in a pan, I'll melt some butter, and as it's starting to get a little bit brown, I'll put in one diced onion and a pound of orzo. And I'll cook those for about 10-15 minutes till the onion caramelizes and you get a beautiful nutty brown color to the orzo. And just as that happens, I add about 2.5 cups of chicken broth to it. And just as it's starting to get al dente in the pan, I'll add maitake mushrooms, shiitake mushrooms, and some crimini's. They'll give up their moisture and actually rehydrate the orzo as it's cooking. And just as it's done, I pull it off and stir in a little bit of Reggiano Parmesan cheese, a little chive, and just as we put it on the plate, I'll shave some white truffle. And it's just absolutely delicious.
Do you slice them? Do you put them in whole?
I slice the shiitakes, I slice the criminis, and I gently break apart the maitakes.
Okay. And are these mushrooms available at the market as well, or are these domestic mushrooms you get in a grocery store?
All available here at the market.
Okay. All right. And then it's white truffle season in California.
We're getting white truffles from the north, Northern California, and I think they're even bringing some down from Oregon.
Uh-huh.
But they're beautiful.
Okay.
And they're a lot less expensive than the Italian white truffle. They're also not $3,500 a pound this year.
Oh, my gosh. What is David West charging for his white truffles here?
I think they're $15 an ounce, which is really reasonable.
And you can do this dish. If you're shaving a white truffle, you can get away with half an ounce?
Oh, yeah. Actually, an ounce goes a pretty long way. Mm-hmm. You can stretch it for 4 to 6 people, so it's pretty economical.
This is wonderful. I love the idea of the caramelized onions and starting out with the raw pasta and kind of a nice twist on a risotto, and it's
a really, really lovely dish, and sometimes I'll just do the orzo ahead, and I'll put it in a pan, and then I'll just reheat it as guests are arriving, and then I'll finish it with the white truffle, just as people are about to sit down.
Okay, and you no need to pre-cook the mushrooms. You just toss them into the simmering broth.
Okay. Absolutely.
Well, David, that sounds so good, and it's so seasonal, and it's so great to know that the white truffles are back for their brief appearance right around the holidays. This is perfect timing.
Enjoy. Mangiare. Happy holidays.
Thank you so much, David. That was David Rubel. He is a private chef. If you come to the market, you will see him running around with his cart and his head full of recipes. And he's always great to chat with, as you can tell. We're very inspired by his recipes. We're visiting now with Greg Nauta of Rocky Canyon Farm. Greg brings in grass-fed, grass-finished beef and I guess you feed your pigs a lot of your vegetables, too, but they're all free-range animals. So, Greg, can you maybe explain a little bit the difference in taste, texture, and cooking times of your grass-fed as opposed to the corn-fed type beef?
What we've noticed is with grass-fed, because it's a leaner meat, it cooks much quicker. So if you're going to do a rib roast, its rule of thumb is about 15 minutes per pound. Store meat usually is about, because they're bigger, they tend to be 25, 30 minutes per pound. Really depends on the thickness and the amount of marbling in it.
Okay, so you say yours is leaner, so there's less marbling, but it does have, I think, because I eat it all the time, I think it's just got a great flavor.
The flavor is much richer, yeah, definitely. It's not, it's what it's naturally supposed to be as if they were roaming in the wild.
And when people do make the distinction, as I did just now, to grass-finished, because people are kind of getting on this grass-fed bandwagon, but then they'll shove them into a feedlot and fill them with corn, right? So you want to make sure they're grass all the way?
There's a lot of different twists being put on it. They're really starting to use the term and really walk a thin line of what they really are. Grass-fed usually means they are grass-fed all the way through. Some guys will grass-feed when they're younger, up to a certain age, grain finish them, or they'll grain them up to a certain point, put them on grass for a few days, and call them grass-fed.
Oh.
And it's really a shame that they do that.
And I've noticed it does taste different, and anybody who tastes it will be able to taste the difference. Okay, and you are at 3 Santa Monica markets, Wednesday, Saturday downtown, and Sunday Main Street. I'm glad you're doing this, because so few people actually do what you do.
Thank you.
That was Greg Nauta. He's a grower, a farmer from Rocky Canyon, which is up in Atascadero. He has grass-fed, grass-finished beef and pork. We didn't mention, but he also has wonderful yams and delicious winter squash that go great with these pork and steak things you cook in your oven. You can slow roast them all. We are going to be closed the Wednesday after Christmas. Wednesday, December 26th, the market will be closed. The other Santa Monica market, Saturday and Sunday, will all remain open throughout the holidays. From everybody here at the Farmers Market program, our staff, our volunteers, and all of our farmers, thank you everyone for listening, and have a wonderful, healthful, bountiful New Year and Christmas. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
On a slightly personal note, despite the fact that it's a Monday, my place, Angeli Cafe, will be open on New Year's Eve for our regular casual dining. So if you're looking for a place to go that's low-key and delicious, call us for reservations at 323-936-9086. Holiday times are not just about the big piece of protein sitting in the middle of the plate anymore. It's also a time to go crazy for all the side dishes. In fact, I'd rather eat side dishes than the main course. I've asked Deli Times food writer Russ Parsons to come by and share his favorite vegetable preparations. That's next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. During the holidays, it always seems that the main course is made the star of the plate, when for me, it's the side dishes that are the most interesting to eat and to cook. With me here today to talk about holiday side dishes is Russ Parsons of the LA Times. I love grazing, and I just think when people come over and they see a table laden with choice.
And, you know, I think at this time of year, somebody asked me, like, what my favorite season is, and it's always, for me, it's always the one that I'm in. And winter's got kind of a bad rap, but, you know, I love root vegetables.
Okay, so let's talk about what constitutes a root vegetable. What are we talking about?
When I talk about root vegetables, I don't usually include potatoes. So I'm thinking about things like turnips, rutabagas, parsnips, parsley root, celery root, things like that.
What is a rutabaga?
A rutabaga is also called a swede. It's genetically very, very close to a turnip. It looks, if you saw one at the market, it looks just like a turnip, except it's a little bit more golden, kind of tannish color to it. And I think it's a little bit sweeter and a little bit less horseradishy than a turnip is. But, you know, if you get a bunch of those things, peel them, dice them, turn them in a little bit of butter with some white wine. Mm-hmm. Just glaze them with some pepper and maybe some herbs at the very end. It's one of those things where the sum is greater than the parts. It all adds up into this kind of alchemy where you get this very, very rich, developed flavor from it. And it cooks very, very quickly.
Do you throw carrots into the mix?
I would definitely include carrots, and more carrots, the better. You know, I mean, the more different kinds of carrots, the better. Carrots aren't just orange anymore. And even with those things, I mean, as long as we're talking about root vegetables for that, you know, For me, the Christmas dinner always has to have a big roast, a crown roast or a prime rib or something like that. If you get a bunch of those root vegetables and just blanch them and then throw them in the roasting pan at the very end so they caramelize in the roasting juices. Oh, my gosh. That is so delicious.
That is so delicious.
When I braise them, what I do is I cut them into similar sized pieces because they all have roughly the same density. I mean, they do, as long as they're the same size, they'll cook in about the same amount of time. Put it in a cold pan with a little bit of butter and a little bit of white wine, and then cover the pan and cook it over medium heat until the vegetables begin to become tender. When they begin to become tender, turn the heat up to high and remove the lid. And what will happen is you'll see that when you take the lid off, that there's all this moisture that's come out of the vegetables. Well, it's all got great flavor. So the water from that will evaporate, and what's left behind is just this amazing, like, root vegetable butter-flavored glaze that is just one of the most delicious things ever. Mashed root vegetables are wonderful. Gratins of root vegetables. One of my favorite gratins is if you slice boiling potatoes really thin, slice turnips really thin, put them in a gratin dish with a couple of tablespoons of butter and then roast them without any cream or anything until they start to become tender. And then pour over just enough cream that the tops of the vegetables are kind of poking out. I read a description once where somebody said they look like alligators in the
peering up from the swamp.
Peering up underneath. You know, they're looking. And then put that back in the oven until the cream reduces and thickens. And that's an amazing gratin. There's great flavor.
I love the combining of potatoes and turnips. They have such an affinity for one another.
Right. It's a good marriage. You know, they kind of supply the thing that the other lacks.
Well, let's start going beyond root vegetables. Yeah. What about greens this time of year? And what are some of your favorite greens these days?
I hate to admit it, but you know what I do? I'll pick up a bag of those pre-chopped mixed southern greens, cook them with some garlic and throw in a little bit of lemon at the end. It's a great complex flavor.
So, Russ, I understand that you've had an interesting holiday impediment. Let's not say disaster. Let's say impediment.
This qualified very, very close to it. It was well before I started being a cook. Back in my sports writing days, and I went to my first Christmas dinner at my soon-to-be in-law's home. And my future mother-in-law got everything all ready. It was this big meal, and everything was terrific. And there was this gorgeous, gorgeous turkey just laid out. And she looked at me and she said, "Would you like to carve?" And I'd never carved a turkey before. I don't even know if I'd ever carved a chicken before at that point. I mean, how can you refuse something like that?
Your manhood is at stake.
Well, man, and future familyhood. It's like, am I worthy? I was not worthy. So fortunately, we were in the kitchen. So I started working the turkey as best as I could. I have no idea what that looked like anymore. But I got the breast all carved, and I had to call my wife in, and I said, Kathy, where's the dark meat come from?
See, now that will just make people feel a lot better, because the thing I love about food is that you're just always learning. So even if you start from a place of knowing so little that you don't know where the dark meat is.
Knowing less than nothing.
You can grow up to become a very well-known food writer.
I'm not sure whether that says more about cooking or about journalism, but...
Thank you so much, Russ.
Thank you.
Check out Russ's recipes online at kcrw.com/goodfood. Russ Parsons is a food writer for the Los Angeles Times and author of a great book, How to Pick a Peach. Normally, Pulitzer Prize-winning food critic Jonathan Gold hunts through mini malls looking for authentic regional food of the world. Most of these dishes have a price point of about $8. Today, he goes a little more high-end. Next on Good Food, Jonathan Gold takes on white tablecloths and multiple wine glasses. Jonathan Gold, author of countless counterintelligence columns for the Los Angeles Weekly and winner of the Pulitzer Prize, is with us this morning to share a bit upscale suggestion today. Where are we going?
We're going to Valentino.
Valentino on Pico?
Yes. Or rather, we're going to the wine bar at Valentino.
Ooh, how fabulous.
Because I think Piero Salvaggio came to the conclusion that he didn't necessarily want people to go only on anniversaries and birthdays divisible by five.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, Valentino has this reputation of being a real special occasion place. So what is the food that he's serving there?
It would probably be close to the antipasti in the restaurant, except they have a new chef, Taco Tabucci, who seems to be sort of in charge of it.
And so what is his take on antipasti?
If you've been to like elaborate banquets at Valentino, you've had some of the stuff. You've had the frico, the fried cheese chips. You've had maybe the culatello. He gets a wonderful culatello, which is the heart of the prosciutto. There's a big salumi plate with some pretty much the same stuff everybody else gets, but you know it's of a very high quality. And of course, it being Valentino, the wines that go with it are of extraordinary quality.
I mean, he has one of the most famous wine cellars of any restaurant in Los Angeles.
He does. And I can't think of anywhere else where you can go and, you know, get a glass of 88 Dunn Howell Mountain Cab or a 93 Aldo Conterno Barolo. The list is so vast that you are very, very unlikely to see, like, Santa Margherita Pinot Grigio.
It must be so much fun for him because he has this list and he must want to just share tons of it with people. So it's a great idea.
Yeah, you get to taste a half dozen wines. They have it by the glass. They have it by the Cortina, which is nice because it's really two glasses.
Two glasses.
So it's enough. It's enough to share taste with a bunch of people. And there are some dishes that they do that aren't necessarily part of the regular Valentino thing that are good. Last time I was there, they had some wonderful ravioli, which was dressed with a big spoonful of tripa alla romana. And it was very good tripe. I mean, tripe isn't easy to find in Los Angeles, and it was a totally satisfying dish. The chef is Japanese, so his way with crudo, the raw fish preparations everybody's doing, is particularly deft. Probably the usual things you'd see every place, but dressed with, you know, obviously extraordinary olive oil and grated salts and such.
Well, for some people for whom crudo isn't usual, give us an idea of what we could expect.
When they bring out the crudo plate, it actually looks like a composed sashimi platter. Some things are propped up. Some things are lying flat. There's raw tuna. There's raw, yellowtail. There's all kinds of fish. And everything is dressed with a different condiment.
And what is the price point of the food, but also the wines? The wines that he's pouring by the glass, these sort of exceptional choices. What do you have to spend to get a glass of something special?
There are, oddly enough, like $8 wines that are
wonderful
to drink, mostly from Friuli or from the South, but, you know, very well-chosen wines you'd be happy with. And if you're going for one of the big-ticket wines, it could be substantially more expensive. I mean, actually, I've never seen another place that had $50 by the glass wine, but it's a wine that you're probably not going to have a chance to taste otherwise. So if that's something you really want to do, it might be worth it.
$50 by the glass. I mean, I guess you could, charge that off to educational expense.
Right. And if you're with, a few people and you're tasting a bunch of wines, then it may almost seem worth it to be able to have a glass of old properly cellared Barolo, which is not something you can walk down to, BevMo and buy.
That's true. It sounds like a really wonderful thing to do during the holiday season, go with a bunch of colleagues or friends.
Yeah, and the idea of stopping at Valentino for, a plate of culatello and a glass of Barbaresco after the movie at the New Art or something is just wonderful.
Give us the address of Valentino.
Valentino is 3115 Pico Boulevard in Santa Monica.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you very much.
Jonathan joins us nearly every week on the show. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Weekly. Check out kcrw.com/goodfood for more of Jonathan's restaurant suggestions. In 3 days, Christmas descends. Millions of kids across the country will put out a plate of cookies and a big glass of milk. And of course, millions of parents clean that plate and down that glass of milk. But what's the right food to leave out for a guy who's got a large, jiggly belly? Tips coming up next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. You know, a lot of homes this month are going to be getting a very special late-night visit from a man who, despite his girth, manages to have a phenomenal level of energy. So what are you preparing to feed Santa when he stops at your house? We thought we'd ask Will Clower if we should feel guilty about maybe feeding that girth. Hi, Will.
Hi.
So I know that you're very interested in health, and I thought that you might be worried about Santa's girth. And you might feel that we need to change the things we leave for him, but I just can't see children putting out a chicken breast instead of chocolate chip cookies.
No, absolutely not. As a matter of fact, I think that the best things that we can put out for Santa are some of the traditional things that we've always done before, like ginger cookies. Oh, think about ginger cookies. Traditionally, they've been used to reduce nausea, for example, by motion sickness. Now, listen, Santa needs that.
Oh, yeah, he does. He's
absolutely
flying all over the place.
Exactly, zinging through the world and all. And ginger also, in your ginger snaps, can help to eliminate harmful intestinal bacteria in case somebody, you know, gives him something that doesn't agree with him. And ginger itself, raw ginger, is it raises your metabolic activity. It also helps to alleviate colds and coughs and inflammations and even flatulence. Now, if you leave out those ginger snaps, chances are Santa's going to give a few of those to the upwind reindeer as well. In any case, it's going to be very well appreciated.
Now, you mentioned reindeer. I guess it's not an appropriate time of year for Santa to feel that you've been eating reindeer burgers at
your
home.
No, that's right off the list. Don't leave out the reindeer burgers.
And what about the reindeer? Should we leave some things for them, too?
Oh, cranberries and carrots are awesome. Cranberries have just a raft of medicinal purposes that would be fantastic for them, that they would just love. It cleans up urinary tract infections, ulcers, heart disease, cancer. The main thing, Evan, don't agonize. Whatever you make for Santa, do it with love, and it'll be received that way.
Now, what about the classic plate of chocolate chip cookies and
critical.
Milk?
Critical. Think about Santa. You know, he's in the North Pole. There's no sun up there. How much vitamin D is this man getting? You get vitamin D from that milk and also from the egg yolk that's in the homemade chocolate chip cookies. Or you could combine those two into a steaming mug of cocoa. Then you get the chocolate, you get the vitamin D. It's all good at that point.
Well, it's really nice to know that children don't have to put their present quotient at risk by leaving the wrong types of goodies for Santa.
No, absolutely not. I mean, think about Santa. You know, he's an elf. From his point of view, cookies and milk could be like broccoli and Brussels sprouts to us. And it could be, we could be doing more harm than good than trying to recreate him in our own little image of health. You know, just let the jolly man be the jolly man.
Thank you so much, Will.
Oh, you're welcome. Good to talk to you, Evan.
Will Clower is a neurophysiologist and neuroscience historian. He's the author of The French Don't Diet Plan and The Fat Fallacy. I've got more info about Will on our site at kcrw.com/goodfood. The holidays aren't only about eating and drinking. They're also about giving. I want to tell you a story about a USC student who's come up with a way to take the excess and spread it around a little. That's next on Good Food. A few weeks ago, I participated in a seminar at USC. It brought me into contact with some very interesting students that have created an inspirational project. Bronson Chang is one of the students behind the USC Dining Dollar Food Drive. If you're a USC parent or a student, listen up. Hi, Bronson.
Hi, Evan.
What are dining dollars?
Dining dollars are basically an amount of dollars on students' accounts that they are required to purchase at the beginning of the semester.
So if you are a student and you live on campus, you have to buy these dining dollars so that you can be fed throughout the year.
Yep, that's the system.
And the parents are given different dollar options, and a lot of them choose the excessive option to be sure their children have food.
That's normally the case.
Now, you say that it's kind of inefficient. How is it inefficient?
It's inefficient in that a lot of students aren't able to spend all the money by the end of the semester. And the way the system works is if they don't spend that money, it just goes to waste, or the university profits.
So tell me about the project that you and a few others have put together. How are you trying to make these leftover dining dollars more efficient?
Okay, well, it's very basic. We place barrels that we got from the Los Angeles Regional Food Bank at different locations around campus. Students, all they have to do is go into these locations, swipe their cards, pick up food, and drop them off into the barrels, and then we'll deliver it to the food bank.
And did the food bank give you parameters of what kind of food they want to have put in those barrels? Because I would imagine there's a lot of not very nutritionally sound options for students on campus.
Yes, definitely. The food bank, they recommend foods that will be very nutritious to the people they will be serving them to. So a lot of things that we look for are things such as peanut butter, tuna, very nutritious kinds of foods that will be used to help feed the homeless in the community.
And do you encourage students to sort of use a little bit of excess dining dollars throughout the season to make these donations, or does it seem like it's sort of an avalanche towards the end of the year of just trying to get rid of the dollars?
Well, that's usually how it's like, because students don't know if they'll have too much by the end of the semester. So it's not until the end that they realize, oh, I have all these dollars. I have to get rid of them. And here's a great solution to that, the Dining Dollar Food Drive.
And give me an idea of what the monetary amount of the excess dollars might be for a typical student.
Well, this drive is pretty young. We started in 2005. In the first semester, we raised about $5,000 worth of food. Last semester, 2007, we raised around $8,000 to $10,000 worth of food.
If a particular student has eaten a lot off campus this year and they have quite a bit of money, maybe a few hundred dollars left over that they'd like to donate, can they get help from you in one of your people accompanying them to a campus outlet and help them deal with all the food?
Yes, definitely. It's not something that they have to really go out of their way to do. We're starting to implement volunteers who will go to the shop and take off a couple hundred dollars worth of food from the shelves, drop it off in the bin. So it's really easy for anyone who wants to donate.
So tell us once again where people should go for more information.
We have a website. It's www.diningdollarfooddrive.com or diningdollardrive.com.
And what is your monetary goal this year?
Hopefully over 10,000.
That would be great. Thank you, Bronson.
Thank you, Evan.
Bronson Chang is a sophomore at USC. Go to diningdollardrive.com to find out more about the program. The link is on our site, too, at kcrw.com/goodfood. There's one other thing we do besides eat at the holidays. We also gather. And when we gather, we sometimes get stuck having to talk to people who are, well, frankly, boring. So what to do? Advice from the etiquette expert next. That's in 1 minute, right here on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Some find parties fun. Others know that being stuck with people you don't know can just be a big drag. So what can you do? Today I'm turning to Chow.com's etiquette columnist, Helena Eichlin, for some advice. Helena, this time of year, when we're going to all types of parties, New Year's parties in particular, there seem to be a lot of dips around. And that activity, which is often called double dipping, of dipping your chip in something, taking a bite, and then going back to dip it in again, is often viewed with total horror. Should we be horrified, or are people making too big a deal out of it?
Well, I found out that somebody has actually bothered to do some scientific research into this question. She's a professor of microbiology, and I interviewed her a couple of days ago and asked her about the study. And basically what she did is she had got five dips from the supermarket, and then she had her students double dip in the dips, and then she left them to sit at room temperature for an hour, and then she took a sample from each dip and measured it, and she found they had negligible levels of bacteria in them, i.e. double dipping isn't really as heinous and unsanitary as we all think.
Yeah, because I remember as a child, everybody double dipped and nobody said anything, and then all of a sudden it just sort of crept into our culture. How socially offensive do you think it really is?
Well, it may be a personal thing, and it may be because I actually prefer that people not do it. Because it's like, I think it's like spitting on someone when you talk to them, like a little fleck of saliva lands on you when you're talking to someone, and it's not unpleasant, and you're very unlikely to catch anything from it, but I would rather it didn't happen, and it's easy to avoid. But I don't think it's the guest's responsibility to avoid double dipping, because when you're standing around dips at a party, you're drinking, you're talking, you're not really thinking about, you know, chip etiquette. So I think the host is the one who should prevent double dipping, and it's easy to do that just by making all your crudités bite-sized, cutting them up small, and then just getting the bite-sized tortilla chips.
Now I'm very interested in this idea of someone spitting on your face, which might happen during New Year's. You know, everybody's
yes.
imbibing. You have a drink in one hand, you have your dip and your chip in the other. What if somebody does have that spit land on our face? What do we do?
I think this is a dilemma, because if you do wipe it off, the person will probably notice, and then they might be embarrassed that they've done that. But then they'll say, I'm sorry for spitting on you, and you'll say it's not a problem. But
I think the proper thing to do is for the spitter to go ahead and wipe it off of the spittee.
At a New Year's Eve party, that could be a form of flirting and could lead to...
That's true. It could lead to something that you don't really want. Well, let's talk a little bit about that. Let's talk about mingling. Is it the host's responsibility to sort of bring shy people out into the party?
I think you have to make some effort. And the way to do that is you just introduce them to someone and then say, Bob, Betty is a skilled accordion player. And... And then tell Betty something about Bob, and then they have something to start off with. And you could make a couple of introductions, but then after that, the shy person can't sustain a conversation. I mean, you have other duties as a host to worry about.
But I like that idea. I like the idea of not just introducing people with a name, but like a one-liner that is sort of, it piques one's interest. So it would be easy for the shy person to follow up with a question.
Yes.
What if... people are not leaving. How do you get them out of your house?
You can just say, everybody, I'm going to have to throw you out. It's been great, but I'm really exhausted and I need to go to bed. But I think that also kind of ends things on a slightly sour note. So if possible, you want to give them subtle hints and make them think that it was their idea to go. And so I've devised a three-step strategy, maybe it's four steps, to help people get rid of guests who stay too long. And the first stage is environmental cues. So you dim, you turn the lights up, you turn the music off, you turn out the candles and that sort of thing. And then the next stage is verbal hints. And here you use a technique that I call the before you go technique. And so you use the phrase before you go. And then after that, you ask them a flattering question with a short answer. So here's an example. Before you go, you must tell me where you got those wonderful boots. And then they answer the question, but you've implanted the going idea in their head, but they aren't really offended by it because they're sort of feeling flattered by the fact that you love their boots. And it actually works. I've tried this out several times.
And what if that doesn't work, which is stage two? When do you bring out the big guns?
Sometimes people are drunk and they just don't get those kinds of hints. So the final stage, if you're really desperate, of course, is pajamas. But you want to be careful here. It's not the time to break out, you know, a filmy negligee.
That might send a whole entirely different message.
That strategy could backfire because I've done this, changed into my pajamas several times, but I don't actually sleep in pajamas. I sleep in like sweatpants and like a t-shirt. And so when I come into the room in this outfit, I think a lot of the time people think, oh, Helen has just changed out of her dress because she wants to be really comfortable and settle in for a long chat.
Oh, gosh. Time to get a pair of those Nick and Noras with the funny dogs on them.
Oh, yeah, exactly. You keep them specially for such occasions.
Absolutely. Thank you, Helena.
Thank you.
You can find Helena Eichlin at Chow Magazine. I've got links to her columns on our site at kcrw.com/goodfood. One way to ease social anxiety is to pop a cork of bubbly wine. A rundown of some of the best champagnes and champagne-like drinks of the season coming up next on Good Food. It's a festive time of year, and what's more festive than a few glasses of bubbly? Nothing, really. Jennifer Nugent of the Colorado Wine Company in Eagle Rock is here with us today to give us some ideas for that most celebratory of beverages. Hi, Jennifer.
Hello.
So I guess we should start with the real thing, champagne. Now, Why is that the real thing?
Well, the area in Champagne, France, is where Champagne proper comes from. And rightfully so, they definitely defend that name very vociferously, and that's the real deal.
So if it doesn't come out of Champagne, we can only call it?
Sparkling wine, bubbly, Cremant. Lots of names for it, depending on the region.
Well, let's talk about Champagne, though. What are a couple suggestions you could give us?
A couple that have really just stood out to us. One is one called Camille Saves, and it's a Premier Cru Brut. And that is from Champagne. It's actually from an area called Montagne de Reims. And in Montagne de Reims, they have three different grape varieties. That's the classic blending of Champagne, Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier, and Chardonnay. Now, those are the only three grapes that you can use in Champagne. They're very specific about it. This is a gorgeous, dry, yeasty, really fine, tiny little bubbles.
Oh, I love
completely
that.
Completely unique. It's gorgeous.
And what is the price point for that wine?
That's $53.99.
That's not
store.
Too bad. How about another one from Champagne?
I also really love a recent addition for us called Le Brun Severnay. It's a 1997, so that's a vintage.
It's a vintage. That's unusual for Champagne.
It is unusual, and it depends region to region and year to year as to whether or not that particular Champagne maker is going to deem 1 year's grapes worthwhile of bottling.
Yeah, I love that with Champagne. It only is vintage if it's really something special.
Absolutely.
So give us the name again and describe what it is you love about this particular Champagne.
This Le Brun Cervenay 1997 by Patrick Le Brun. It's almost ferrous. It's almost metallic, but in a really beautiful, specific way. It's almost got a pencil lead quality. Which...
So that would be good with some luscious, full-bodied things to eat.
I think so. I think that Champagne can almost be put with every food, but some of the bigger, more voluptuous champagnes, which in my opinion this is not, can overtake some food. So yeah, I think that you're right on that.
Pencil lead. I love that. I've never heard that descriptor.
I might just be making that up, but I think that's what it smells like. And it's just wonderful. It's got such an incredible way of sitting in your mouth and the way the fizz kind of, you know, settles in your mouth as well. It's just so great.
And how much is that bottle?
That's $72.99. That's getting up there for us over at Colorado Wine Company.
Well, it is, you know, the celebration of the end of one year and the beginning of another. If you're going to blow a little bit of money on something good to drink, now's the time to do it.
This is the one. And my theory is that, honestly, the better the champagne, the less likely your headache. Now, maybe that's just because I love it.
I like that theory, too. Now, what about bubblies that are not from champagne, but you think are really delicious in a great price point?
Well, one of our perennial favorites at Colorado Wine Company, and one that, you know, we just have success with again and again with lots of folks, is one called Domaine J. Lorenz. And I think probably a lot of people that are in the know about bubblies that are not necessarily from champagne have probably heard of this bubbly. It's got a gorgeous plain silver label with black cursive writing on it. It's about $13 a bottle at our store.
And it's French?
It is French. It's from an area called Limoux, which is in the Languedoc region. And it's a different blend of grapes. It's a little bit of Chenin Blanc, and they have to be at least like one-third Chenin Blanc, and a grape called Mauzac. And it's got a great scent of light green apples, but it's brut. It definitely finishes dry. It's just got a bit of a heavier, spicier weight in your mouth, which is what Chenin Blanc is known for. We just love it.
For people who like to have something that's not quite bone dry, but they like that more Italianate maybe, mm-hmm. of something that's a little bit more fruit to it, what do you have?
We do have a gorgeous Prosecco right now that I love that it's about the same price range. It's called Bartolomeo, and it is from the classic region of Valdobbiadene. It's got, again, that green apple note to it, and then a slightly herbaceous quality, which ranges from rosemary to dill, depending on what you're pairing it with. Those qualities really do come out. So they don't have that kind of super, super dry kind of ferrous quality that I was talking about with the Sauvignon.
Mm, they sound wonderful. Do you have anything else for us?
I also love a recent Cremant that we just added called Albert Mann. And it's Cremant d'Alsace, which is way up there north in France. And it's got this incredible weight. It's four grapes that you hardly ever hear about, at least in the general market, being blended into bubbly. It's Pinot Blanc, Auxois, Pinot Gris, and Riesling.
And what's the price point for Albert Mann?
That's it. Yes, it's $21.99.
Now, of course, the great allure of bubblies and champagnes are the bubbles. What creates the bubble?
It occurs because of the secondary fermentation that occurs in the bottle. That's what makes it a natural fermentation instead of the headache-inducing kind of temporary bubbles that you get in very inexpensive bubblies. That's what makes it what it is. It's called Method Champenois. And the bubbles of gas are actually dissolved into the wine with the force of being trapped in that bottle when it's capped. When you open the bottle, the bubbles aren't actually in the wine until you crack it open, which is that great pop, and then the bubbles come alive, and they've got a life of their own.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jennifer Nugent and her husband run Colorado Wine Company in Eagle Rock. Her suggestions are listed on our site at kcrw.com/goodfood. Congratulations to Jennifer. She had their first baby this month. Braising's a cooking method you should really know all about. So in case you don't, Queer Eye for the Straight Guys' Ted Allen is coming to get you sorted out. That's when Good Food returns. Stay tuned. Once the weather starts to change and we feel a bit of nip in the air, we start to hear a lot about braising. Ted Allen is with us this morning for some tips on this delicious technique. So slow and low, is that what we're talking about?
Oh, absolutely. And just hearing those words makes me hungry.
So describe for a new cook out there what braising is.
Braising is one of my absolute favorite ways to cook meats. for a lot of reasons. It signals that, as you said, that nip in the air. It's also a cooking technique that allows you to buy cuts of meat that often are less expensive because they're tougher, but they're also typically much more flavorful than the beef tenderloins of the world. And you can produce some stunning center-of-the-table masterpieces using the technique. Generally, what braising means is to cook meats in liquids, in flavorful liquids, whether they're stocks or wines or a combination of the two, often in sort of a Dutch oven. You can do it on the stovetop or you can do it in the oven. And the happy consequence of cooking meats in these liquids is that they produce a ready-made sauce for or a ready-made base to make some terrific sauces as well.
And are they always cooked covered?
I believe they are, yes. The idea of braising, as contrasted with roasting, they both might happen in the oven, but with braising, you're cooking in a moist environment. You typically would want to brown your meat first in an oil or butter or something, and then add the liquid, just so you have that caramelization or that browning on the outside of the meat. But then I would keep it covered so that it's cooking in this moist environment and absorbing all these great flavors and liquids and juices and falling off the bone.
Now, I hear that you're a big fan of braised pork shoulder.
Absolutely. The pork shoulder is a great example of a cut that is very inexpensive and one of the most flavorful parts of the pig. It's sometimes called pork butt or pork picnic, and it's a great cut because it's filled with all sorts of fattiness and sinew and stuff that you would not want to eat if you tried to cook it quickly. But if you take a pork shoulder and put it in some liquids, you can cook it for several hours, and it just keeps getting better and better, especially if you can get it on the bone. Pork shoulder runs about $2 a pound, so it's a very economical meat and a really flavorful one.
Besides pork shoulder, is there any other cut that you really love to use for braising?
Well, I mean, I have to say the most famous braise, in my opinion, would be the classic veal shank ossobuco, which is you're actually taking a section of the leg, and this is an ornery part of the animal that you probably wouldn't want without some really long, slow and low cooking in a moist liquid, maybe a red wine. I'd start off by sautéing the mirepoix, which is the onions, carrots, and celery, and a little herbs. After those vegetables soften, splash in some wine, some salt and pepper, and you take your veal shanks and put them in there. I love to do this in those French cast-iron enameled cookware. Cover that up and throw it in the oven for a couple of hours. And when it's finished, the meat just falls off the bone, and it's tender, and all of the fat has rendered, and it's just such a wonderfully homey, rustic, flavorful dish. And it's a dish that actually in a restaurant is not cheap. The shanks themselves are not terribly expensive, so it's a good way to go, and it's celebratory, and it's holiday, and it's a wonderful way to eat.
I remember last year I was with some friends in Umbria for a really good friend's birthday, and I, of course, opened my big mouth and said, well, I'll make the dinner. And actually, I ended up making ossobuco, and it just filled the house with this incredible aroma. And that succulence is just, you can't get that with any other cut.
No, you really can't. And for the diehards, you get the marrow in the bone, which also has a lot of flavor and adds so much flavor to the sauce, and the windows frost over. Yeah, everybody needs a friend like you, Evan. They need a friend who's a great foodie. They need a friend with a boat, and they need a friend with a lake house, with a little cottage on the lake.
Oh, now I know what to work on. Now I understand. Actually, I've seen recently pork ossobuco starting to show up on restaurant menus, and so I tried doing it once, combining the two things that I love, the idea of ossobuco and pork. And I have to say, it's really delicious, and it's fun to play with complete other kinds of flavors, like to do sort of a barbecue ossobuco with the pork.
Oh, what a fun idea. The more I hang around with food people, the more I learn that the noble pig is every chef's favorite animal. It's just so flavorful. And I have not tried that part of the pig in a nice cast-iron enameled pan. I'm just, God, the head reels. I'm thinking a little Alsatian Riesling maybe, some garlic, some oregano.
And at the end, what kind of bread and condiments should we use?
With our pork ossobuco, let's see. I don't see what kind of, well, you're going to have a great sauce.
Right.
from all those wonderful flavors. So you've got to have some kind of great crusty bread. And as with some of the other preparations that you do with pork, I think it might respond really nicely to some sort of a chutney, maybe some sort of a something fruity.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, it would probably be really good with cranberries.
And there lies another great idea for the holidays.
This has been so great. Thank you, Ted.
Thank you, Evan. Great to be with you again.
Ted Allen has a PBS TV series, Uncorked Wine Made Simple. He's most well known as the wine expert on Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, and most recently as a judge on Top Chef. Vegans, I haven't forgotten about you. Early in the show, I confessed my love of vegetables. Let's forget that meat ever was missing and dive into a New Year's dinner. It's coming up on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Let's beef up the show with some good veggie food, some great beer, and supremely listenable music. The Hot Knives are with me this morning, otherwise known as Alex Brown and Evan George. They have a blog where they put it all together to share tasty moments in the kitchen and at the table with us. So what are we making for New Year's?
Today we were going to do baby baked potatoes as sort of an appetizer because obviously for New Year's you're not going to even get to full plates of food once the champagne or champagne-style beer starts flowing.
Now, as vegetarian folks, you won't be garnishing these baby potatoes with caviar. So what are you going to do with them?
What we like to garnish our little potatoes with is veganaise. There's a very nice store-bought brand called Follow Your Heart that we use quite frequently.
Swear by it.
We swear by it.
Do you tart it up?
We do. We actually add a pinch of nutritional yeast. And
what does that do?
Nutritional yeast and brewer's yeast are both kind of used by vegans and hippies alike to give sort of cheesy quality to a lot of their food.
It's usually grown on beets, actually. And of course, the sugariness of the beets doesn't come through at all. It ups the ante with the savoriness a little bit. And it can be substituted as cheese if you're really, really extreme about it. We are not.
So what kind of potatoes do you use and what's your technique?
In this case, we would use just sort of standard baby potatoes, whatever you can get at the farmer's market. They need to be big enough that you can split them in half and serve them like a half of a baked potato, basically. So you can use your own judgment. If you find some good Peruvian purple potatoes that are big enough that they'll work, use those. But in this case, what we do is split them in half. We knock off the edges so that they will sit flat because you don't want a teetotaling potato on your appetizer plate.
Yeah, so all you really have to do is take a little paring knife and just shave off a little bit. Just there's a little bit of a base.
Exactly. Then we like to take maybe a teaspoon or a small spoon and carve out a little bit of a crater in each half of a potato.
You do that before you bake it?
We do. It could be done after, but you want to get them to the point where they really are the consistency of a baked potato, and you can risk carving out too much that way. So they're nice and firm. You scoop out a little bit of it that'll hold the filling eventually. And you toss them in a big pot with cool water, salt, and bring them up to a boil. Once they boil, they are done.
Ooh, fabulous. So you drain them.
Mm-hmm. And ice them very, very quickly. What's nice about this kind of dish is, you know, it's a really, really non-complex way to cook potatoes. And if you really, really do turn them off and cool them down the second that they boil, they won't be waterlogged, so they'll still taste very potato-y, but they'll have a doneness that's verging on crisp.
Are you then going to reheat them later, or are we going to eat these at room temperature?
We generally serve them at room temperature. Something like a party where we're hosting, the chances of throwing them back in the oven before topping them with a vegan crema, you don't really want to have that chance.
I like how realist you are. So we have our little hollowed out potatoes. They've been boiled. They've been iced. They're ready to get their garnish. And once again, refresh my mind about the garnish.
Well, there's a vegan cream filling, which is basically just veganese that's been spiked a little bit with a number of spices. Some of our favorite spices, and we use them a lot on the blog, are different smoked things. So we've already got the nutritional yeast in there, but then you add some cracked black pepper, some smoked paprika, some smoked salt. Those flavors will sort of boost the faux bits of bacon that you can buy from any sort of health food store, which is basically like dried texturized TVP, texturized vegetable protein, that gives it a nice crunchy finish.
You can even use bacon bits because they are actually vegan.
And so this is a nice dish to pop in your mouth while you're drinking too much.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So what would you pair with these little potato bites?
Well, we were recently talking with a friend who asked us, you know, I don't want to serve champagne with New Year's. I'd like to try a beer. And so we were trying to think of some beers that could be substituted really well for a champagne. In this case, we would probably go with Deus Brut des Flandres, a Belgian beer that's brewed in Belgium and then shipped to the Champagne region of France and treated as if it were a champagne and aged in oak barrels. The yeast is extracted and then recorked. So you end up with a really smooth, bubbly liquid with none of the sort of ugly yeast that beer freaks like us generally go for.
And it's a really pretty package. And when the cork pops, it pops a lot like a champagne cork.
That's correct.
Mmm, yummy. Very small bubbles, if I remember, in that
very
beer.
Very small. And it has those sort of nice, like, you know, slightly sharp flavors that you can get from a lot of champagnes. I mean, it masquerades a lot. And we've actually experienced some disapproval from some of our beer geek friends about liking this beer. It's kind of a mixed bag.
It's also really pricey. So it's a special occasion beer.
What is pricey?
It's about $25 a bottle, which is kind of astronomical in terms of craft
yeah,
beer.
Yeah, that's true. But, you know, it is New Year's.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And what music are we going to be listening to while we're coring out these potatoes?
Well, we're pairing this dish with a Brian Eno song called Here Come the Warm Jets. It's an extended track that has a real sort of floaty rejuvenation theme to it that works well.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Alex Brown and Evan George are the Hot Knives, two guys who love to cook but happen not to cook meat. I've got links to their blogs and video podcasts at kcrw.com/goodfood. You can find info on today's show, watch the latest videos of Good Food, including the newest podcast on how to sex a fennel, and hear past episodes online at kcrw.com/goodfood. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show's produced by Thea Challoner with Bob Carlson, Candace Moyer, Connie Alvarez, and Holly Tarson. The music supervisor is Gary Masiha. Special thanks to Karen Soriano. I'm Evan Kleiman. Join me next week for another edition of Good Food.